Welcome to episode 6. I'm Adam McCubbin. I'm really excited to share with you this podcast today. There's heaps of information that is really valuable and you can take away and use it straight away. But before we get into this podcast, I would like to invite you to leave a review on either iTunes or Stitcher. This would greatly help the show and gain exposure. And in my appreciation, I'm running a competition for the chance to win 1 month's free online training with myself. All you have to do is leave a review in iTunes or Stitcher, take a screenshot of the review and then send it to me. You can send it via Facebook, Instagram, email, or whatever is easy for you to do. Today, I'm interviewing Tim Crowe, who's a career research scientist in the area of nutrition and sports nutrition. Tim is one of the thought leaders in this area and someone who has a high level of credibility and not to mention a huge following because of the quality of work that he does. In this interview, we talk about what makes good science and what is the best way to find out if the research is credible, the importance of fiber, and what the science says about red meat, plus some great practical advice on health. I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I did recording it. Now, let's get started. Okay, so today we've got Tim Crowe here, who is a career research scientist and educator in the area of specifically nutrition and sports nutrition. He now works as a freelance writer in the health and medical area and a scientific consultant as well. Now, just a bit of background, Tim was an actual lecturer of mine when I was at Deakin University and really identified with Tim. He had a great sort of teaching style and wasn't too dry at all, and made the area of nutrition a lot more interesting for myself. So without further ado, welcome Tim to the podcast today.
Thanks very much for having me on, Adam, and it's good to see former students doing so well for themselves as well. So it's great to have this chat as a professional colleague nowadays. So looking forward to it.
Awesome. All right. So just to lighten the mood, I always do this with my guests, just to get a bit of a lighthearted approach to it all. What is probably one of the stupidest or silliest, most embarrassing things you've said or done in your career? It can be any stories, anything you can look back on now and think, why the hell did I say that?
So many to choose from. I think the highlight for me would have been a lecture I was giving. It was on alcohol, and I thought I'd make it a bit lighthearted and throw in a little video clip about how alcohol affects you as the percentage increases. So, you know, one drink, you're a bit relaxed. At two drinks per hour, you're sort of laughing and having a bit more fun. At like four drinks, that's when guys start thinking that they could dance. You know, that sort of comedy relief in a video clip. So it ran for about a minute or two, got lots of laughs. When the clip finished, though, it actually, the website I took it from, and the ads were some very adult entertainment, which got broadcast into the lecture theatre, which I finished the lecture by saying, and that's how I lost my job at Deakin University. So yeah, by unintentionally, the students got a bit of hardcore porn near the end of the lecture, which I couldn't hit that.
Yeah,
but just for a second, it was up there. So yeah, that was a career highlight for me in a lecture.
Yeah, no fault of yours though. It's just those things happen. For those of you who might not have heard of you or read your stuff before, can you just give us a history of how you started your career and sort of the evolution of that and what you do specifically now?
Okay, so I started off in medical research, more basic laboratory type research, in working in many different areas, in particular cancer and diabetes. But I found when I was doing research work, I was always fascinated by papers I read to do with nutrition, in particular sports nutrition, just from a personal perspective. So I found that the work I should have been doing, I wasn't as interested in it as I should have been with a PhD working as a postdoc scientist. And I just, you know, loved assuming all of the nutrition research. And the time came for me to think about, well, I'm really interested in nutrition. What sort of career could I follow? Of research and thinking about it, dietetics came up. So I actually went back and studied did a nutrition and dietetics degree at Sydney University. I worked as a clinical dietitian for a year or two, but the lure of research in academia was strong. And I went had got my appointment then at Deakin University. I had a very good 16 years there as you know, doing teaching, research, all that sort of stuff. So many fine students such as myself come through. But in January last year, I made the decision to start moving on from the research environment into more of a medical and health communication and consulting work, running my own business. So it was a bit of a scary step to make, but I've been transitioning to it slowly over time. So I haven't looked back over the last year. So now I get to do what I like most of the time, although it's always what the client dictates is the work you do for them. But a lot of it is now focused on medical and health communication, which I'm very passionate about, particularly in the area of nutrition, where there is a lot of need for good, clear, concise, accurate, incredible communication.
Yeah. And I think also a testament to you as well as your blog that I read, and obviously many other people read as well. It's very easy to read for even people who haven't got a nutrition background. And I think, is that something you enjoy as well? Updating that blog and putting out sort of credible information?
Yeah, absolutely. I do love doing that. I've had the blog going for a couple of years just as a bit of a hobby, because but that now has transitioned into more of a career. That it's not so much the blogging I do. I write for many different websites and magazines and whatnot. But sort of the blog has become sort of my, you know, electronic CV for the sort of work that I do. And I make it all freely available. And that's sort of my way of distilling out a bit of the crazy in the nutrition world and giving my take on things. And then from there, my Facebook page as well has been growing over the years as well. And there's a lot of, you know, additional nutrition commentary I give on that. And there's about 34,000 people that follow that. So that's, you know, not too bad influence nowadays in the world of social media.
Mm-hmm. And is there someone in the space, obviously, other than yourself, that obviously you've had a bit of a shift from academia and now you're moving into that commercial side of things. Is there someone you've sort of aspired to, or you look at their work that they do and you think you sort of model yourself after someone like someone else?
Yeah, well, there's probably a person I really look up to, and any most Australians would know of this person. That's Rosemary Stanton, who's been like the face and voice of credible, reasonable, sensible nutrition advice for decades upon decades upon decades. She is extremely thorough and concise, incredible, and very evidence-based in how she communicates her nutrition messages. And she is one person I try and emulate for thoroughness and how she communicates nutrition and bring it back to some sensible basics and practical advice for people as well. So she'd be the one person I really look up to strongly. But there are a lot of good people doing work in nutrition communication in Australia as well, and they're getting good profiles from it.
Yeah. And shifting into like the science-based nutrition, and obviously it's your area of expertise. Now, for the common person, when you're reading a newspaper or you get headlines come up on Google News or anything like that, how do people decipher whether it's good versus sensationalized sort of bad science? Is there any sort of pointers and things you like to refer to?
Yeah, probably a few little points of advice, because bear in mind, not everyone has a luxury to go back and get a science degree and learn critical analysis. So what sort of things can you make sense of? My first one is that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. So if you're seeing clickbait headlines on newspaper websites or coming up in your social media feed, is there high quality, repeatable evidence to support that, or is it from one single study done in mice? So, you know, the bigger the headline, the bigger the evidence that want to back it up. And unfortunately, clicks and traffic, so the headlines don't always match what the substance of what the work's about. So it's about the claims. It could be looking at research with very small sample sizes. So that's not as impressive as, you know, big numbers that have been followed for, you know, many years. And in nutrition particularly, there is a tendency to combine or to say that correlation equals causation when they're very different things. So correlation is what you get when you have observational research. So we find that, you know, people that eat 3 servings of blueberries each week have lower rates of heart disease. I mean, that's all well and good, but could there be other things about their lifestyle that could explain that? Research is trying to allow for that, but you can never remove all of the unknowns in this sort of research. So quality intervention studies rank higher than observational research. And does the message you're hearing or reading, is it just something that's come out of left field that's a game changer, or does it fit with the narrative of prior research? It's really the second option's the best one. There's not too many fundamental shifts overnight in nutrition. You know, generally it's a slow, gradual build of research rather than just one particular study turning everything on its head.
Yeah, and that's I tend to get that a lot with the people I work with. They'll come in and say, oh, you know, they've seen this latest thing, red meat causes cancer, or they'll read something that's very sort of over dramatized, and it's hard to get them back from the ledge and say, look, this is, you know, just based on one study and sample size, etc. Is there anywhere on the web other than obviously your own blog that you would go to decipher that science, like a bit of a shortcut for medical literature and nutritional literature that might dispel some of those myths?
Yeah, probably the best site on the internet, and it's a pretty big call, but you know, I've evaluated a lot of this stuff, it's examine.com. It's one of the best nutrition sites for independent, unbiased critical analysis of breaking research, as well as a whole lot of range of nutritional products and supplements and so on. They have a lot of free stuff, but they also have a fairly excellent research digest, which is a small fee to subscribe to, but it's well worth it for anyone that wants the best information. It's one of the few sites that I actually use that I feel that I gain value from it, apart from my own, you know, reading of 20 or 30 different journals and so on. So examine.com gets my 5-star rating as the best site on the internet for quality nutrition information.
Oh, awesome. That's a great tip. What sort of media is that? Is it all just written stuff, or is there videos, or do they have like a podcast or anything like that?
They have most of it's written stuff on there. They have some, but the quality of the work, they have a lot of infographics, which is, I love infographics. It's a great way of getting information across, but written in a consumer friendly format. So there's a lot of information to peruse on there. The quality stuff, the bulk of it's free, but there is some subscription service attached. But if you look at the people behind it, there are dozens of PhD level researchers that are involved in putting it together. And there is no sponsorship whatsoever that occurs on the website. Any of their income comes from their subscription service for their research digest. So I think it's an excellent site.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great tip. I'll put this in the show notes as well. What are some areas of research that we should be looking out for in the next few years pertaining to health and perhaps even performance as well around the nutrition space?
Yep. I guess I had two things. First of all, for the hottest topic in nutrition research is the gut microbiome. You know, it's everywhere. There's headlines every day about the gut microbiome, how it could affect our body weight, how it can affect our risk of disease, how it can affect our mental health. And there's new discoveries coming out about it all the time. A lot of it is overplayed for the headlines that you read. Action is going, it's probably our gut microbes can have the biggest impact on our health. And the interesting thing is that a lot of the variability that we have as human beings to particular foods could be related to our gut microbiome signature. And the best thing about this research is that even though it's a massive area of work, there are 500 to 1,000 different types of bacteria in our gut, the population changes over the time. There's only one thing you really need to know, and how to have a good healthy gut is eat lots of fiber, and that's plant-based foods. That's the food they love and they thrive on. So fermented food is good, but plant-based foods high in fiber is pretty much what it all comes back to. And that's what nutrition guidelines have recommended for decades. Now, the gut microbiome gives it a real sexy angle to sell it, which is why I'm very excited to talk about gut microbiome. And in the other area, probably more of a bit of relevance to what you're interested in, is the sports nutrition space. And that's really evolving. Two big areas is to do with this concept of personalized nutrition, which you would think that always occurs, but you know, probably in the olden times, you know, the olden times of sports nutrition, even though it's a fairly young science, there was a perception that sports nutrition is all about high carb and protein. Well, we know that there is a continuum where athletes can thrive on different types of diet. And of course, low carb is fairly big in the sports nutrition world at the moment, despite the fact the research is nowhere near as rosy of those that pointed out. But rather than just black and white of high carb versus low carb, you know, high protein, whey versus casein and so on, individualizing recommendations for athletes is where things are going in sports nutrition. And I'm keeping an eye on is that to do with the area of carbohydrate mouth rinsing. And it's just phenomenal that just 10 seconds of mouth rinsing with carbohydrate sports drink, even if you spit it out, gives a performance advantage in events up to 75 minutes in duration. When I first saw that research, I thought, this is just crazy. It can't be real. But it's real, which is just amazing to think that carbohydrate receptors in our mouth can actually improve performance just by having a mouthful of a carbohydrate drink, and it doesn't have to be sweet, just some level of carbohydrate. So carbs are not the devil. They do have a role to play in sports nutrition.
Yeah. And with your, when you obviously people reading sports nutrition and nutrition just in general, how do you go from applying the information that you might get from a study? Obviously studies are looking on a sort of macro level. How do you then apply it as a practitioner to more of an individual setting? For example, if you're coaching someone or you're teaching someone to lose weight, how would the research then be applied in that setting?
So what I like to go back to is the sort of the basics of nutrition research. And if you look at decades and decades of research, you know, what's the common theme that comes out of research? And this is what I consider the core of dietary advice. Everything else around it is playing on the edges. And the core basics of what is considered a healthy diet has changed very little. It's a diet that's mostly high in minimally processed plant-based foods. Bear in mind that most food we eat is processed to an extent. So lots of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, beans, nuts, seeds, and that's low in added sugar and doesn't include a lot of red meat is consistently the best diet linked to good long-term health, and pretty much any health marker you want to care to mention is related to that sort of dietary pattern. Amongst that, there's a lot of scope for individualization. We all have different foods we like eating at different times of the day. That's where the individualization comes from. So I like to say, get those basics, core basics right, and that's 80% of the battle. After that, it may be a customizing based upon portion sizes, based upon personal likes and dislikes, someone's diet history, what's worked for them well in the past, going with that. But if you have the core basics right, then you can add in a little bit of the extra foods that you read about in research. So if it's about protein, for example, in sports nutrition, you know, whey protein gets a lot of press, but overall there's good evidence for other forms of protein as well. So you can really customize what works for the individual. And the key thing is you can have the best research advice in the world, but if someone has to follow it. So, you know, just because this particular food's giving them the best benefit, they might not like it. Therefore, you know, find an alternative for it. So basics right, then tweak it around the edges with the research. Rather than in the sports world, it gets turned on its head. It's the sexy research to do with the supplements that may give at best 1% or 2% performance benefits, and the basics of a good healthy diet may get ignored when that's when the biggest gains are made, particularly for more the sub-elite and weekend warrior type athletes. That's the biggest focus, not supplements. Get your core diet right first.
Yeah. Is there anything emerging at the moment? I mean, you just spoke about the use of carbohydrate swishing in the mouth. Is there, obviously there's lots of research around whey protein, but anything that's sort of off the beaten track that people might not have heard of that's possibly got good implications at the moment?
Yeah, so two things that have been appearing over in the last 1 to 2 years, I'm seeing a lot more on, you know, in my social media feeds and Google, but they're supported by good research, is tart cherry juice may help with recovery. And another one is pickle juice, which the research is saying it may help reduce the risk of cramping. So when you first see these things, they just sound like, you know, old wives' tales sort of remedies, but they're moving up the ranks for probably good evidence-based sports nutrition supplements. And probably just slightly behind that, as far as it's been around for a little bit longer, is beetroot juice, which, you know, is probably very popular sports nutrition supplement. And the evidence is quite, you know, reasonable that it will improve at least, you know, more sprinting type performance. So some beetroot juice if you like taking it.
Yeah, and I'd be interested to hear. I've been sort of playing with this a little bit myself, just personally, and I've read some of the literature, but I wouldn't be probably across it as much as you. But in terms of intermittent fasting, benefits, drawbacks, who's it good for, or if you think it's good at all, or is that something you're not au fait or would recommend?
I have an approach now that if it works for a person, go for it. And there's been enough research done in intermittent fasting to show that the initial excitement for it was a bit overblown. And a lot of that came from Michael Mosley's doco and book in 2013 called Eat Fast. Oh, I've forgotten the last word of it. Anyway, it was a very popular doco. And that exploded. Can you help me out? What was his book? The Eat Fast Diet or something like that. Yeah. Anyway,
it was the five and two diet.
Five and two diet.
Yeah. That's the one.
The doco is called Eat Fast Live, I think, but the 5-2 diet really exploded intermittent fasting. And because of that, a lot of research that's been done. And what does the research say? That in the end, if you're looking at weight loss, there's no major extra benefit of intermittent fasting versus a, you know, typical calorie controlled diet. Some people do well, some people do not so well, but they're not, it's not streets ahead. It can work for an individual, but if you look at averages, it's nothing that you'd say everybody should go on intermittent fasting, because in the end, it's as if everybody followed a low-fat diet or portion control or so on. There may be a slight advantage for metabolic markers, but you know, it's a huge one. So I say with intermittent fasting, if it appeals to you, if you like that way of eating and you could adhere to it, if it's out of it, but it's not a blanket recommendation that everybody should try, because being hungry is not nice. So for some people, it could be detrimental to them.
Yeah, definitely. It's something that I've played with, and I liked it more from a lifestyle perspective of not having to worry about that sort of first meal and, you know, going into a fast for 14 hours. And I just, the actual thought of not having to worry about eating made it actually simple. So it's just going with that in terms of lifestyle. I mean, obviously that's moving a little bit away from research, but are there lifestyle things that you'd suggest for general populations in terms of getting habits and nutrition under control?
Yeah, most definitely. And the thing about intermittent fasting, and there's no one accepted protocol. So it could be you alternate, you know, one day feasting followed by one day fasting. The 5-2 diet is, you know, 5 days of moderate calorie restriction and 2 days of feasting. But there's other protocols that are 16 hours of fasting followed by 8 hours of feasting. So it's really variable. So you can sort of pick is what works for you. I've tried a little bit myself. There's one thing I'll say about it. When you have your first mouthful of food after maybe 10 hours of fasting, the taste of the food is just incredible. first bite. So it makes you appreciate and savor food. But also you can, you know, tend to eat quite a bit when you do it. But if it works for an individual, go for it. But it's not a magical panacea. Just like there is no magical diet. If there was a diet that worked for everybody, it will be out there now. Everybody will be on it and everybody will be succeeding at. What we hear though is stories. I was on a low carb diet and lost weight, therefore everybody should go on it. No, that diet worked for you. Whereas other people, intermittent fasting worked for them. But other people, so switching from a junk food diet to a vegetarian diet, transformed their life. Lots of anecdotes and stories. And for those individuals, fantastic. And so long as you can adhere to that dietary change, to make. So gone are my days of poo-pooing diets. In the end, if it works for you, you're eating better, you're feeling better, and you're healthier, then stick with it. That's the hardest bit. It's not losing the weight, it's actually adhering to it. That's the difficult bit. You can lose weight on easy, you know, dozens of diets to follow. It's sustaining it that's the hard bit.
Yeah, and I think that's where people sometimes get into not trouble, but they think the diet's, you know, the answer to all their things, but it's just because they've gone from eating probably processed junk to whatever, whether it's a paleo diet, whether it's a ketogenic diet, whether it's a vegan diet, they're getting more nutrition in there. So therefore they're going to feel better.
I would say for most people, that's really the change they're seeing. Perhaps they've tried other diets before and they haven't worked, but they're still shifting from a lower base to a higher base. Because if you look at all the diets, paleo, vegetarian, low carb, Mediterranean, whatever, they have differences, but they have a lot of commonalities. And the commonalities is low in added sugar, high in high fiber plant-based foods, and not a lot of, you know, other sorts of discretionary foods outside of it. And that really is what the core of healthy eating is about. They differ outside of that, but the core of it is plants, not a lot of processed junk, and eating healthier. And that's going to be better for most people.
Yeah. Are there any like big red flags in terms of food groups or food types that you'd advise people to stay away from? Obviously junk food, but is there for example, if someone was overeating too many omega 6s or is there any research or what are your thoughts on that?
It's funny. Okay, junk food aside, we all agree on there's probably only one type of food that even for myself I make a change from. It's red meat. If you look at all of the evidence for foods, and you can find any study to show you any food can be harmful for you, but foods we consider as fairly the core of a basic diet, it's generally red meat that comes out as a food you wouldn't want to be having a lot of in your diet. Outside of that, you know, particular fruits, vegetables, you know, whole grains, dairy foods. If they agree with you, eat them. But we've got a huge variety of foods we can choose from. So if you find that grains, you know, are not that wonderful for you, well, there's other alternatives you can have. If you find dairy foods don't agree with you, well, there's alternatives you can have. It's not a matter of just a blanket banning of particular foods. There's a huge variety you can choose from. So it's only red meat I put up as a bit of a flag. And if you look at dietary guidelines, they generally say eat plenty of all of the foods, and that's one of the foods that they recommend not having as much of.
Yeah. And when it comes to, I'm not sure if there's a lot of research, I haven't looked into this, but if you've watched any of the food documentaries, they always slam, but the factory farm type foods, obviously cows on grains, not eating grass, and then battery hens, the effects that it possibly could have on the meat and therefore on the people who eat the meat. Is there any research to back the claims that a lot of those documentaries make?
Well, certainly it's true that depending on how the animal's been reared, that affects the quality of their meat to an extent. But our biggest health problems in the Western world isn't because of the type of red meat we're eating or our form of poultry. It's overabundance of calorie-dense, sugar-rich, salt-rich that's our biggest issue. So this creates a bit of unneeded noise in the equation. If you've got everything else perfect in your diet, then, maybe you want to have grass-fed beef rather than grain-fed beef. But overall, it's only going to make a fairly small difference when you look at all the other things that we eat in our diet. So I'd put a lot on my list of priorities. But these sorts of docos get a lot of noise from it. Like, this is the smoking gun. This is the problem with our diet. No, the problem with our diet is in the middle aisles of the supermarkets in big, shiny packages with long ingredients lists. That's the problem with our diets.
Yeah. And going back to on the individual level, is there tests and services that you'd recommend? So I do a lot of coaching with clients, and I always refer out to sports nutritionists and other people that might have a bit of a better understanding, and specifically to doctors that will give them the tests. What areas should people be looking at in terms of biomarkers and things that can be altered, obviously, with nutrition?
So I generally, if someone is feeling fairly healthy and well, to me, there's no major needs for a lot of tests apart from a general health screen. They can be useful for tracking. So if you look at, you know, for an average person, a nice marker of chronic disease and inflammation, which inflammation is pretty big in the inflammation, is a MRP that's of use.
Yep.
The things iron can be of benefit having, but if someone's feeling healthy and well and no signs of iron deficiency anemia, there's probably no need for it. So there's not many major biomarkers I would say that someone should have to go and get monitored. If they're performing well and they've got a fairly good diet, if something is going astray, then perhaps getting investigated further with a doc. But as far as blanket screening, it's not needed. Interesting, a couple of companies now are getting in on the nutrigenomics space, offering some more tailored genetic tests with the sports nutrition focus. So to look at potentially people, if they maybe are fast or slow metabolizers of caffeine, that can be of benefit to know. If they may be a slow or fast recovery from injury or from training. So these are very much emerging areas, and that's probably where more benefit would be seen. Get a bit of a genetic profile to know what sort of training and what sort of sports may suit you a bit better. In the nutrition world, probably would not at the level of having really good biomarkers to say this is the magical one you need to watch. And, you know, if you follow this diet, you'll see these big changes and you'll start winning gold medals on the track.
Yeah, that's some great advice. I've had a few people do it before, and I'm not actually convinced that the tests are actually that accurate. That you get a lot of like food intolerance tests, and I've found that people, if, you know, for example, they're eating Brazil nuts or they're having eggs, as soon as they go get the test, that'll be like the top two intolerances that comes back. What efficacy and what do you actually hold any merit to those sort of tests?
So, yeah, if you're getting it done from a recognized, reputable practitioner and lab, they may have some use. But I notice you use the word intolerances. You know, for most people, it's allergies you're interested in, and that happens at a fairly young age. Intolerance is a very more of a difficult one to assess, because an intolerance may not happen from a particular food you're eating. It may have happened over the last few weeks from a buildup of particular foods that have added to it. So it's much harder to do testing for. So I'm always a bit cautious about that, particularly for adults. If you've got true allergies, you've probably had it for life, and that would have been identified when you were fairly young. So what you're probably looking at there is people may be giving advice about, you know, food sensitivities, perhaps.
Yeah.
And the where there is the strongest research about food sensitivities is to do with the area of something called FODMAPs. Does that ring a bell for you?
Yes.
Yeah. They're pretty big. And there's a bit of sports nutrition work being done in the area of FODMAPs as well, particularly for GI tolerances for athletes. Obviously, you want your GI tract running well when you're performing. So it's probably FODMAP testing that might be the most benefit. But I wouldn't be recommending any blanket, you know, food sensitivity tests and so on if someone is otherwise feeling well, because if it's not done from a reputable place, you may just get a bit of a blanket recommendation and a cookie cutter approach when really it's not tailored for you, and maybe the results are a bit spurious. And a good example is hair analysis, which is just pretty much bordering on fraudulent. But people get hair analysis done, told they're deficient in all these particular nutrients, given all these tailored diets and supplements, when really, if you send a hair sample to a bunch of labs, you'll get a whole bunch of random numbers coming back from every lab. You know, they're fairly meaningless, unless you've got heavy metal poisoning. Otherwise, hair analysis tells you nothing. But this practitioner is giving a dietary advice based upon hair analysis, and it's just quack science.
Yeah. Now, just shifting gears into perhaps more of the performance space and hypertrophy in particular as well. I get a number of clients looking to gain a little bit of extra muscle. And I actually did a research paper in my Deakin studies on protein consumption in particular for hypertrophy. And I've just, I've still... haven't come to a number or a recommendation that I'd give someone per gram what is going to work. And I've found for myself, actually, eating far less protein has been beneficial for me, but which is contradictory to what the science is. I'm probably at about 1.6 grams per kilo of body weight. So, I mean, that's not low, but
that's reasonable.
Yeah, so compared to some of the research that you read, you know, you can see people eating up to 3.3 grams per kilo, which for me I just wouldn't agree with. But what have you found in the research?
So if you had asked me this 2 or 3 years ago, I would have said, you know, that the recommendation for the upper limit is 1.2 to 1.7 grams per kilogram body weight. You know, no one else needs any more. But there has been a little bit of research that's come out in recent times to show that, yeah, perhaps in the twos, 2 grams, you know, 2 to 3 grams per kilogram body weight may have some additional benefit as well, especially if an athlete is both trying to lose weight and obviously maintain muscle mass. There's a good case for higher protein intake if someone is trying to, you know, cut down body weight. The additional protein will be of benefit. So I'm not as dogmatic now. I'd say that there can be a case for higher protein intakes, and there may be some additional benefit to have that. And of course, then we have the timing of the protein as well. You know, it's probably good to have it fairly soon after your workout, but there is not some magical 1 minute before a window. If you don't get your protein shake 1 minute after you've done the bench presses, you're going to lose all your gains. It's probably a much wider window than what you initially thought. But spacing your protein over the day, a bit of research as well showing that casein protein, people forget about casein, but casein protein, which is a slow release protein, may give additional muscle growth benefits when you take that at nighttime, because you have that in your system slowly coming out all throughout the night when you're sleeping. So it's not a case that it's whey protein and everything else is rubbish. Fast protein, slow proteins, and different forms of protein all can have a benefit. So I'd say whey protein is king, but there's a lot of other proteins you can be included in your diet which will give you fairly good benefits as well. And why whey protein is king is because of its high leucine content. You all know about what leucine and its activation of the mTOR pathway, and you've probably wrote about that in your research paper at Deakin Adam.
Yeah, definitely. With also, what are your thoughts on, obviously closely connected, but branch chain amino acids, and there are a lot of science around that, but what are your thoughts on branch chain?
So I look at the science of branched chain amino acids, and I'd say unless you have a critical illness and in an intensive care unit, which is where the good research has been done, in a sports performance benefit, the research is not that strong that these are a huge additional benefit overall. So yeah. I'm not excited about branched chain amino acids as individual supplements. If you're having high biological, high quality protein, you'll get quite a few of these in your diet as well. But as far as a supplement goes, it's not something I'll be recommending at this stage based upon sports nutrition research. In the medical community, there is good evidence, but that's a very different situation.
Yeah. And what would you say in developed countries, what are sort of common deficiencies, and what would be the case of then supplementation? And that comes back to, I mean, would you be someone who'd recommend a multivitamin or people taking vitamins at all, or is this more of unnecessary if you've got a balanced diet?
Well, the thing about multivitamins, it's easy to say everything we need we can get from food, but we don't always have the best diet. So I always say that a multivitamin is a good insurance policy that you could take every second day. It contains a bit of everything, but not too much of anything. And that's about as far as you need to go, unless you've got some serious concerns about particular nutrient in your diet or you've got a diagnosed deficiency. So stick with just multivitamins to start with. The most common nutrient deficiency in the developed world is iron deficiency. And it's not just vegetarians, it affects a broad cross-section of the population. So that's a very common deficiency. Potentially omega-3 fatty acids. Obviously, you would know about those. Because we don't eat a lot of fish, we don't get a lot of omega-3. So there may be some merit to consider an omega-3 supplement. But after that really starts tailing off, is what I would recommend is supplements that people would take as a broad recommendation. Multivitamins, omega-3s, and after that, personalized to whatever your biochemical tests are telling you.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially where I'm living currently in Dubai, there's huge deficiencies in vitamin D because a lot of people don't spend much time outdoors because
that's amazing, isn't it? Yeah.
And referred out to doctors, and just that a lot of insurance companies they'll offer just general testing, and I'd say probably 8 out of 10 people that come back with a vitamin D deficiency. So
that's amazing. I just think of Dubai as sun and sand dunes, but of course, I guess the clothing people wear there would cover a lot of their bodies, and it's all indoor mall shopping. Is that right over there, Adam?
Predominantly, yeah. especially the locals, they don't get out in the sun as much. Sort of for me on the weekends, I actually enjoy getting out and getting a bit of sun. But obviously, some people don't, and a little bit scared of the effects of sun. But yeah, that's another argument in itself. Now, just changing gears, we're sort of getting to the end here. I'm just interested. Obviously, you're a high performer and someone who's done well in their career. So, I just want to sort of dig deep and understand your personal habits and routine and things that that have worked for you. What is your sort of your habits that you have, and your sort of your morning and your day look like?
Yeah, so I'm a runner, a marathon runner at that. I mean, it's been an obsession for the last 15 years. So I'm running every day. And even after all this time, I still have to just make that mental effort to get myself out of the door every morning. But I do it. I still do it. So morning run, and then gym will be at nighttime, 2 or 3 times a week. So that's sort of my physical activity that I love doing. I always feel good after it. But even now, I still have to motivate myself to do it. So the benefits from it are pretty good. The rest of my day around that, though, is about dealing with the work of the day, eating fairly regular diet, nothing, no super, not full of superfoods or supplements, no banning of particular foods, just eat what I like and try and not have too much junk food. So that's about it.
Yeah. And in terms of habit, I heard you. So obviously you push yourself to get out the door. How do you, because that's a huge thing in terms of getting people to comply. And I find people generally that I've worked with that start an exercise plan, they just by habit, they start eating a better diet. Is there any things or tricks that you use maybe personally or when you recommend for students or anyone for personal habits and developing a good routine?
So for me, it's having making it as easy as possible, so reducing those barriers. So you've always got your gym gear fairly handy and easy to get to. You've always got some continuous in place, and maybe you've got a mental map of how your week will look. Maybe you don't get every training session in there, but you set yourself some goals for that particular week. And the thing I like about running is, you know, using a GPS watch, you've always got that motivating factor. And even now, whenever I go to the gym, I always have the plan I'm on, but, you know, trying to slightly do better than every other time. So that's obviously incremental increases over time, but just creating that motivation, that gamification, that competition with yourself is enough to get me out there every day and, you know, hit your weekly goals. That works quite well, and that gives you a nice dopamine hit as well, because that's what we thrive on, and that's what dopamine is. That's can be getting some reward for the work that you put in there, but you need that goal and that motivation in the first place. So that's all. Yeah. Nothing too secret, just making it as easy as possible and accepting that you're human, and sometimes you are just going to have to push yourself. So I eat fairly well, and I'm pretty healthy, and I'm fairly fit, but even after 15 years, I still have to force myself to put on my shoes every morning and go out for a run, particularly in the middle of winter.
Yeah. Do you have any vices, chocolate, coffee, wine, anything like that? Or are you?
No, it's unfortunate. I think all that running over the years sort of beats out most of your vices. If I have one beer, I'm almost going to hang over the next day. That's the trade-off. If I do go for junk food, I love ice cream. I don't keep it in the house because I just eat it whenever it's there. But if I'm ready to just to do a Netflix binge, I'll just get a liter tub and just smash it and enjoy it. And then I don't keep junk food in the house, but because I just don't trust myself with it, because I'll eat it because it's there. So no too many vices, but I don't worry about it. I don't sweat it, because I, again, you know, 80% is what you want to get right. And that's going to be a fairly core basic diet of lots of plant-based foods. And then what you do for the other 20%, you can have a bit of junk food every now and then. It's not going to be a big deal. So I don't sweat the small stuff.
Yeah. What would your advice be to someone who's perhaps maybe 5-10 kilos overweight and looking to make, you know, New Year's resolution? They want to lose a little bit of weight. Just something sort of really simple that you've found in terms of general advice, and obviously pertaining to nutrition, but also exercise as well.
Yeah. So probably for weight loss, I mean, physical activity is awesome for so many aspects of health, but it does get overplayed for its benefit for weight loss, unless you're really smashing up, you know, huge amount of physical activity. For the average person, physical activity will give you health benefits, but it's not going to be the magical thing for weight loss. It's going to be what goes in, you know, the input side, the food side. Portion control can be a big thing. People think they're eating healthier, and they probably are, but they're eating big portions of it. So in the end, big portion sizes can be just as detrimental to your sabotaging weight loss gains as eating junk food. So I would first of all focus on getting the basics right to make sure that your fridge is full of fruits and vegetables, be it the crisper or the freezer, that you're planning out your meals, and you're just being a bit more mindful of the portion sizes of food you're eating. And that can be anything from breakfast cereal through to, you know, the size of steak that you have, or even the servings of vegetables. That can be probably the biggest place to make some changes. There is no magical eating regime. Some people do well on 6 smaller meals per day. Some people just do well on 2 meals or 3 meals. It's whatever works for you. But you have to find, if you want to lose weight, something has to give. And unless you're going to train for a marathon, it's going to be the food input side. Eat healthier and reduce portion sizes. They're the basics. Whether you want to go low carb, paleo, intermittent fasting, low fat, knock yourself out. If it connects with you, it works with you, and you're eating better and you're losing weight and it's motivating you, keep doing it.
And would you advise someone to look into the actual levels and tracking, for example, like a program like MyFitnessPal, where you can track your macronutrients? Obviously total calories is what's going to be determining how much weight you're going to lose if you're in a calorie deficit or surplus. Is that something you've used yourself, or would you recommend that?
I think these sorts of tracking apps are very useful. They're not for everybody. If someone is a very data generated driven person, they can be very motivating, because it gives you the, you know, the targets and feedback and so on. A Fitbit is a good example, just to get you more active every day, you know, getting your 10,000 step goal or whatever. And they can work really well. They're not for everybody. And also on the the food side of it, there are only estimates. There are errors in the calorie content of food tables. There are errors in what you estimate a serving size. And there's errors in the calories of what's in a fruit and vegetables versus highly processed food. Even though in theory they should be the same, the less processed the food is, the less calories it contains because you actually absorb slightly less of it. So that there's errors in the whole databases that are used. So treat it as a bit of a guideline, not that you have to optimize your diet to be exactly 39% carbohydrates and so on. I've got no idea how many carbohydrates and proteins and whatever. I could get close to an estimate, but that would only be right for one day. So generally just use it as a bit of a tool. If the numbers are useful for you to motivate you, then keep using it. And there's loads of different apps you can trial. But I found that it's the fitness apps that can work well to motivate the fitness side, whereas the diet side of apps maybe not as well because it's hard to get a good track of exactly what someone's eating. And one of the frauds of being a dietitian is if you ask someone what they eat, they will overestimate the fruits and vegetables and healthy foods, and they will have some memory losses for the junk food. So it's even hard to get reliable data for someone to tell you. And we're all human, so perhaps the inputs that go into these apps may not always be the whole truth and nothing but the truth for the person ate.
Yeah, it's definitely true. I think people have a warped sense of what they eat sometimes, and I think just for me, when I coach people, I get them to send me sometimes photos of every meal, and just by getting them to send me photos of their meal, they alter their behavior straight away because they're not going to send me a picture of a Snickers bar or a Dunkin' Donut. Because they start to become aware of those foods.
Dead right, which is useful then if they stop eating it, but perhaps they're the photos they're not showing you. But that's a really good example. Once people are accountable, they do change their diet. But if you're relying on self-reports, that you could get 30-40% under-reporting from diet history. So you always treat it with a grain of salt. It's one tool that a practitioner uses, whether you're a dietitian, personal trainer, GP, whatever. It's just one tool in a range of measures to assess the health of a person.
Awesome. All right. So we're coming to the end of the interview now. I'm just going to ask you a series of rapid fire questions that don't necessarily have to be rapid fire answers, but let them go. So what is your all-time favorite nutritional book and or self-help book?
So for a nutrition book, it's one called The Gluten Lie by an author called Alan Levinowitz, who is not a nutritionist or a scientist. Actually, he has a PhD in theology, which sounds very odd. But the book was about how we've got to, over decades, the fixation with gluten being the devil, the fixation with detox diets, the fixation with sugar being the devil, how that's morphed over decades to do with social influences, conflicts of interest to do with researchers and funding, and how that's been promoted. So it was a really fascinating read about how our image and thoughts about what food is good or bad can be quite distorted compared to the science. So it's one of the best books in nutrition I've ever read, and it's not written by anyone with any qualifications in nutrition. So there you go, The Gluten Lie. Good read. Gluten Lie.
Definitely look at that. Any other self-help books, maybe not even related to nutrition or this area?
I'm into a bit of mindfulness at the moment. I'm on trend with all of my health aspects, so that's a fascinating area, particularly with a bit of Buddhism. But any of the mindfulness literature can be really useful. Just how it could apply to your eating, how to your mental health, so on. I'm a big fan of exploring that a little bit more, and just the aspects of reading about mindfulness actually makes you more mindful. So there's loads of good titles in that area.
Yeah, awesome. Do you have any quotes that you live your life by, or famous quotes that resonate with you?
Very simple one: do unto others what you would have done unto you. That sums it up.
Yeah, awesome. What do you do for fun on the weekends apart from running?
I could say do trail running. That's something, a bit of an occasional treat on the weekend. Otherwise, it's going to be a Netflix binge with a liter tub of ice cream as my binge food. Save all my viewing habits up for a weekend. I don't watch much TV during the week, so that's fun.
Yeah. Well, my next two questions, I think you've actually already answered. It was favorite cheat meal, which is your liter of ice cream.
Demon. Chopped chicken ice cream. Love it. Yep.
And then my next one was weights or cardio, but I have a feeling it's going to be if you're a marathon runner.
Both. It's both. If I only did cardio, there'd be nothing of me left. So weights helps to give it a balance to that. But I needed, for me, it's both of them are important.
Yeah. If you could be known for one thing, what would it be?
To be someone that always is impeccably evidence-based and balanced in the messages that I give in nutrition.
Oh, awesome. Great answer. What's in store for the next 12 months for you, Tim?
So I've been 1 year out now as a health and medical writer and scientific consultant. Lots of new projects coming on. But I'd like to be involved in a bit more in perhaps designing some online courses in nutrition, perhaps through some research digests. So things to disseminate nutrition research much more wider. And also, obviously, to build that into my business as well. So that's probably something I'll be focusing on over 2018.
Oh, awesome. Where's the best place for people to get in contact with you or to find out the latest research and stuff that you've written out? Where's a good place for people to find you?
So my blog /website is thinkingnutrition.com.au or also my Facebook page. It's very active and that Facebook page is Thinking Nutrition. So you can track down my contact details very easy from either of those sources.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for your time. You're very generous to come on here and I've definitely got some resources to look up now. And I think everyone can learn something from this interview. So thank you very much for your time.
Fantastic. Great speaking to you, Adam, and seeing you again. All the best.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Tim has a lot to offer and I strongly suggest you follow him on his social media accounts and even his websites. I'll link to those in the show notes, which can be found at my website, hulk-strength.com. Please subscribe to this podcast through iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn or Google Play so you can be updated for future episodes that will be coming out shortly. Plus, if you'd like some of my free training resources, subscribe to my email list, which can also be found at my website. I have a number of free documents for goal setting, nutrition, and training programs. Also, don't forget to leave a review in iTunes and Stitcher for a chance to win a free month's training online with me. Stay strong, and I'll catch you next time.